This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 81st in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I have a real guru with me today. That is Steve Bellevin. Hello, Steve.
Howdy. I've got the real guru and the gray hairs to prove it.
And there you go. Usually, Steve Bellevin is a professor of computer science at Columbia University. He began teaching at Columbia after many years at AT&T Labs Research. Currently, Steve is on leave to be the CTO of the Federal Trade Commission. Steve's research covers networking and computer security and the way they intersect and interact and collide. Among many claims to fame, Steve helped create Usenet, is active in the IETF and the IAB, is a member of the National Academy of Engineering, and has been awarded the NIST NSA National Computer Systems Security Award. His book with Chez, Firewalls and Internet Security, was one of the first books I ever read on computer security, mostly because I have a very small attention span. And Steve has a BA from Columbia and a PhD from UNC. So thank you very much for joining us today, Steve.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
You spent many years as a researcher at AT&T and then moved on to academia. How often is academic research of the sort you're doing now picked up and propagated into the world versus research, say, at a commercial lab?
There's always a challenge of getting technology transfer. Most companies have a great deal of trouble taking research ideas and turning them into products. It's always been a challenge at AT&T. It's a classic challenge throughout the industry. It's one of the things that research managers worry about a great deal. Mm-hmm. The academic world, you can toss something out there and hope it gets picked up. You can create your own startup. A lot of government contracts, especially from, say, DARPA or DHS, will ask you, what are your plans for commercializing this technology, for getting it out there in the field? Mm-hmm. So doing this kind of tech transfer is always an issue. There are different ways you would approach it in academia versus in industrial research lab, but you always have to think about it.
Mm-hmm. What is your own personal experience with tech transfer over the years? Have you had a success story or a colossal failure or anything interesting happen?
Oh, the worst failure I think I had was with something that Mike Merritt and I invented more than 20 years ago called encrypted key exchange. It was a way to bootstrap a secure network session using only a password as a secret. It was great technically. AT&T patented it, and nobody managed to license the patent successfully from AT&T or from Lucent. It would have been great. Lucent got the patent when it was spun off. It would have been great if the companies would have made it freely available for research use, open source use, then make money from commercial use. It didn't happen that mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. So that I'd call the biggest failure. You know, people invented their own versions of it to work around the patent, which is itself an interesting story in technology and how patents can foster innovation, if perhaps in not the intended way.
But, yeah, they foster it like a rock in a creek sometimes.
Well, absolutely. In this case, the existence of the patent spurred other people to invent their own ways that weren't covered by the AT&T patent, or the Lucent patent.
Tell me about a success in tech transfer.
Well, you know, the Firewalls book that Bill Cheswick and I did, Firewalls would have happened. We didn't invent the concept. There were other people thinking those thoughts, but that a lot of things we put into that book had a large impact on the way the industry developed, yeah, for good and for bad.
Yeah, very good. I think that's a great example. So now we're stuck with them, thanks to you.
I've also written stuff on distributed firewalls, which says that the big guard at the front door doesn't work very well anymore because the world has changed.
Right.
You know, we published that book in 1994. Windows 95 didn't exist. Windows machines, as a rule, did not have internet capability.
That's right. They had no TCP/IP stack.
They had no TCP/IP stack unless you added one.
Yep.
It's a very different world today, and it's one of my mantras, the biggest single mistake you can make in the tech business is you give yesterday's answer to today's question.
There you go. I agree with that. So I wanted to ask you sort of about time, and you know, you've been doing computer security for a really long time, and so you have a good perspective that you know, some of us don't have. Do you think we're making progress in computer security as a field? Do you think we're in some sort of crazy hamster race, or is it cyclical, or are we moving forward? What do you think?
The answer is a definite maybe. I'm not trying to be noncommittal. Most security problems are due to buggy code, which all the crypto in the world's not going to fix. You know, 94 was saying the purpose of a firewall is to keep the bad guys away from the bugs.
Mm-hmm.
Code has gotten a lot better. You know, I looked at one of my machines the other day, a server, and it's been up for about, at this point, 530 days. That wasn't imaginable not all that many years ago.
Right.
You know, something was going to crash it. So code has gotten better. That's the good news. The bad news is we're trying to build much bigger and more complex systems than we used to. More complexity equates to more bugs and more security holes. And the threat model has changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once upon a time, most of the hackers were what I call joy hackers. You know, the stereotypical teenager living in the basement on pizza and soft drinks and no social life and just hacking into systems for the sheer joy of it.
Mm-hmm.
They're the lowest ones on my scale of risk right now. You go all the way up to major intelligence agencies at this point, plus a tremendous amount of hacking for profit. So the attackers have gotten a lot better as well. I was talking with the CTO of a major high-tech company today, and he said that they just assume that their network has been penetrated.
Mm-hmm. That's a good assumption, especially for design. We use that assumption all the time as well.
It's a good assumption. I think he said that when I told him that his company was at risk from foreign governments. And he said he didn't disagree even slightly. He said, yes, we assume that, we know that, and we assume that we're penetrated and try to build security under that assumption.
So you happen to know how I feel about software security, but I wanted to ask your view of the right mix of network security and network security controls and software security.
You know, I once saw a cartoon of police officers staring at a missing section of roadway, and one of them said, "This is a case of highway robbery." You know, most of the things we call network, with a few exceptions, most of the things we call network security, nothing of the sort. The network is the highway to get to the vulnerable hosts.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few things where it is the network or the network infrastructure. When I worry about DNS or routing security, that's part of the network infrastructure. If I'm worrying about eavesdropping, you know, because some links are more vulnerable than others, that's network.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if there's a flaw in some JavaScript app, something or other that's in a PDF document you download via the web or receive an email. No, the flaw would exist if you received it on a floppy disk in the mail,
right,
or by Pony Express. It's a host security issue, but because of the connectivity, you're getting these things more over the network. So the answer is we need a mix of both. We need to fix the protocol problems. We also need to fix the buggy software problems. The network, though, is often, though not always, a convenient way to address some of the host shortcomings. Let's take printers, for example,
mm-hmm.
network printers. These are typically intended for, say, departmental use, fairly small number of people, typically on a single LAN, and there's rarely much need for somebody on the outside to get to it, but printers don't have much in the way of authentication.
Right.
They're embedded systems with notoriously buggy software because they're never updated. So, yeah, you have a little, I call it a point firewall. Turn on a little access control list on your router saying people on the outside can't talk to the printer. They have no reason to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a network response to a low-end host. You can also do other things. You can network intrusion detection, better yet, look for exfiltration in the network.
Mm-hmm.
I'm giving the keynote address next month at FlowCon, a CERT conference looking at network flows for security.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, you can learn an awful lot that way by looking at the network flows. This is the way that the network people can detect a problem on the hosts.
Right. But the problems need to be solved on the host if we want to get to the root.
Ultimately, the problems need to be solved on the hosts, and more we're dealing with mobile hosts.
Right.
You know, when Bill and I wrote that firewalls book in 94, laptops were rare. These days, well, you know, right now I've got two smartphones, a tablet.
Both of more power than all your laptops combined. Huh?
And a tablet and a laptop in my bag. Yeah. And the tablet, one of the phones, and the laptop are going to be exposed to public networks in about 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that mobile security is any different than normal security that we've been dealing with, or is it, you know, is it the same problem in a slightly different package?
I think a lot of it is the same in a different package. The big challenge, first of all, there's location, which is a big privacy issue. And you typically have ceded some control over it to your carrier or your device manufacturer. The other big issue is that they're much more likely to be used on very different, very exposed networks, precisely
right.
because they're so portable.
Right,
and
right.
this increases the risk factor. You're exposed to more. You're exposed to more things. Yeah. Articles in the press, there's a good article in the New York Times a few months ago about threats to smartphones from people traveling to certain countries.
Sure, yep.
But you can't live without a phone, and it's kind of hard not to have a smartphone if you're trying to stay in touch with
yep.
the office, even whether it's a BlackBerry, an iPhone, an Android. You need something if you're a business traveler.
Right. I want to get back to software security a little bit. From my perspective, which is pretty much grounded in the commercial sector, the government lags far behind the private sector when it comes to software security, building security in, proactive security, whatever you want to call it, security engineering. How do you see the state of computer security in the government?
Some things they do very well. Other things I'm not as thrilled with. The process tends to be very good, but that's security by checklist.
Mm-hmm.
Install this antivirus, run this software, don't run that software, centrally managed, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The larger infrastructure questions are a lot harder to deal with. Uncertainties in budget cycle, procurement regulations, and so on make it more difficult to be agile and to deal with these things proactively. Again, I'm only seeing a small piece of one agency close up, so I can't really speak for the whole government. It's not the government. It's this very large collection of agencies, each of which has its own policies.
Right, right.
There are certain central standards like FISMA, but I'm not a big fan of checklists because checklists are the response to yesterday's problem.
Yep.
Like, pick strong passwords. Excuse me, but what is the threat model you're trying to defend against here?
Pimply faced hackers, I think.
It's pimply faced hackers who've stolen the hashed password file.
Right, long ago.
Long ago, you know. On the other hand, strong passwords do nothing against keystroke loggers, phishing sites, subverted servers, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, when that advice came out, that advice dates to 1979. they were dealing with hard copy terminals.
But there was disco. There was disco, Steve.
I don't have a password for disco. The threat model has changed tremendously. You know, you're dealing with terminals that weren't programmable. People would have a power user would have three passwords, and I know by actual count that I have about 100 login passwords.
Right.
There's no way I can remember 100 strong passwords.
Yeah.
And some of the rules, when you add a little bit of psychology, you realize they don't make sense. I was looking at the password selection rules for enrolling in the U.S. government's global entry system.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's a very convoluted set of rules, but you know, letters, digits, special characters. But if you figure that, okay, you need an uppercase letter, that's naturally the first letter of a word,
right.
Then a few lowercase letters, then a string of digits, and then a period or exclamation point. That meets the rules. A few other small variants like that, you come up with only 5 billion possibilities.
Right, it just narrows the space down, which is somewhat ironic, because that's not
exactly
what they were thinking of.
Exactly.
Speaking of global entry, though, you definitely should do that if you haven't done it yet, and you should sign up for TSA Pre, because it rocks.
I've signed up for it, but I've yet to have been able to take advantage of either.
I wore my shoes all day the other day and took an airplane, so it was kind
of,
it was a cool thing. I wanted to ask you what role the FTC might play in moving forward computer security, and in particular software security, since you've been a proponent of software security for zillions and zillions of years.
Okay, so with occasional, with some minor exceptions, for the most part, the FTC is not a regulatory agency; it's an enforcement agency.
Exactly. Yeah.
It does not make rules on what constitutes a secure system, for example. It can, however, act against companies whose insecurity has, for example, resulted in harm to consumers. So let's take the Twitter case, since that was settled by a consent decree 3 years ago. Twitter didn't have sufficient technical or procedural controls on administrative accounts. These were penetrated. Some administrative accounts were penetrated. This allowed the attackers to take over accounts of Twitter users and post nasty things purporting to be from these people, etc.
Right.
There have been other investigations going on. There's one allegation of a hotel chain whose internal computer security was so lax that consumer credit card numbers were compromised.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the FTC, you know, when there is harm, can take action and tell a company, get a consent decree saying, you weren't careful enough. People suffered as a result. Mm-hmm. Now you have to pay.
And that sort of tends to help define what careful enough is, I suppose.
That helps to define it, and it's largely a matter of case law, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. The trick is to make sure it evolves, because as I said, today's threats are not the same as yesterday's threats, let alone the threats of 10 years ago.
Right, right. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. Well, let's get into the Wayback Machine now. So tell us a fun story about the invention of Usenet and the ensuing flame wars.
Okay, so it started in 1979 when 6th edition Unix from Bell Labs was being replaced by 7th edition Unix.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Ellis and Tom Truscott at Duke, they'd helped UNC get Unix up and running. They were running Unix longer than we were. They had this problem. They had this local application. I think they'd originally gotten it from some other Unix running university,
mm-hmm.
that was used for administrative announcements. And they held a meeting. I went over to it from Chapel Hill to decide what should we replace it with, and came up with the idea of a distributed system intended for local administrative use, but also things he might want to share.
Mm-hmm.
And
I guess you underestimated what people might want to share, huh?
It gets better. It gets better, Gary. The very first version of it, and I wrote the very first version of it. It had multiple news groups. It had cross-posting, but the original notion was that you'd have a lot of local groups, but one called Net would go to other sites. Well, that was a shell script. We quickly realized that didn't quite work.
Right.
So I modified it to anything beginning net dot. That's where some of the hierarchy came from.
Oh,
anything beginning net dot was shared.
Yeah.
Anything else was kept locally.
Uh-huh.
We never did, even then, never resolved the tension between who should see it, where it should be distributed to, and versus who is interested in seeing it.
Right.
And that's there are two dimensions to slice a tree. You can't slice a tree in two dimensions. So we engineered the system, and it was my prediction, this is why I don't go into traffic forecasting, that the 50 to 100 computers maximum, again, remember, these were time-sharing computers,
yep.
50 to 100 computers maximum, and 1 to 2 articles a day, mostly in the area we would now call the newsgroup comp.unixwizards. And yeah, I was kind of off by several orders of magnitude on my many orders of magnitude on my traffic prediction.
When I started using Usenet, I had to use NN because I was eating my life.
Right.
And NN seemed like the right way to go.
Well, the first version was rewritten in C by Steve Daniel. And because a shell script couldn't keep up with the load, because shell scripts were really slow on a PDP 1145. But it just had a high watermark. You've read all articles up to a certain date. You couldn't save an article and go back to it while having everything else marked as read.
Right, right.
But again, for 1 to 2 articles a day, this was reasonable.
Sure.
But yeah, the reading technology was driven by the load.
Yeah.
And so it evolved over the years to scale with the load. I'll tell two other stories about it. One is the way it was originally spread. You didn't really have many auto dialers then. They were expensive devices. And, you know, if you're using a PDP-11, you needed not just a serial port, but you needed a dialer device. Yeah. Deck called it a DN-11, which talked to the auto dial unit you leased from the phone company, and you leased the modem from the phone company.
Mm-hmm.
So we and Duke both had acoustic coupler modems, and we designed something. It's two independent designs. I'll talk about mine. We used the control signal, the data terminal ready signal from the computer to the modem,
mm-hmm.
which goes off hook. Well, if you time it going up and down through software, you can do pulse dialing.
Mm-hmm.
So we had software time pulse dialing on a 300 baud dial-up modem.
Yeah, it was before the AT command set, I suppose.
It was before the AT command set. It was a crazy hack, but it worked.
I love it.
we adapted a little bit to the high-speed 1,200 bit per second modems we got a year or two later.
Wee Bob. So I got
There's one more great story on the on Net News that I got to tell you first, and. We wondered about control messages in managing this system. And we wanted to use public key crypto. We'd read the famous Martin Gardner column in Scientific American and the communications of the ACM paper by Ravesh Shamir and Adelman. And we didn't know about certificates, didn't manage to invent them ourselves. So we had no idea how to do key management. We had no idea what the engineering parameters should be, so we gave up on it. But no one had ever heard of the export rules, and the patents hadn't been issued yet. And it's interesting to think what would have happened if in 1980 we had started shipping software worldwide that would have used these algorithms legally before they were patented.
Yeah.
And in violation of the what was then the prevailing export control regimen. That I might have had to have long talks with lawyers about, I don't know. But it's curious to think what would have happened had we been a little bit smarter and realized we didn't need to worry about key management and the key continuity thing, all the things I know how to do now and didn't know how to do 30-plus years ago.
Right, right. I wanted to ask you about when the evil bit was invented exactly and how it worked out.
Well, I'd been using the line for years in talks of what do you use, how's the firewall know what packets to drop? Oh, yeah, well, just look what the evil bit said. And I finally got inspired. I had a plane flight at about the right time to write an April 1st RFC, so I dashed it off on the plane, sent it off to the RFC editor, I guess it was Bob Braden at the time, a couple of days later, and it is still one of the most cited things I've ever written.
It was absolutely awesome. I loved it.
I got all kinds of phone calls and emails. I actually have a web page that talks about some of the lists some of the responses I got. The best one was from a security engineer at Microsoft who wanted to know if this was serious or not and how you really populated the database.
uses Windows equals evil bit set. So was your work with the IAB and the IETF rewarding? Was it something that was fun to do, or did you see it as something that was necessary that you had to do, or crazy mix?
It's a mix. Look, somebody's got to do these things. The IETF, it, at this point, is a large, ungainly organization, but someone's got to produce these standards, and it still does a better job than most. Mm-hmm. The problem I wanted to address was the lack of security attention in the protocols. Now, protocol security is not the only one. I said it's more a software security issue, but when there's a flaw in the protocol, it's a lot harder to fix because you've got to change all the clients and all the servers.
Right.
So you want to get this right, or maybe if there's no security built in, authentication built in, or crypto built in, or what have you, someone who really wants to use this operationally can't do it. And that was my goal on the IAB and later in the IESG, when I was security area director.
Right.
And the really big thing I accomplished on the IESG was to start the process, and it continues, it's much better today, but I started it, of getting the security directorate to review every draft before it's published as an RFC to look for security problems.
That's great. So they would say, uh-oh, cluelessness here, stamp it out.
Well, you want to get some of this stuff done early on. The earlier you see the problem, the easier it is to fix. There was one RFC that I abstained on because it was several years' work and complicated RFCs. It was just not possible to fix it at that point. Mm-hmm. And, an area director can vote yes or no objection. I was not going to vote yes because I didn't like it. I was not going to say no objection because I did object to it, but I couldn't block it in conscience because it was when throwing away several years' work.
Right.
So I detailed as much as I can what the issues were and then abstained. Right. It is significant to note that I think every security area director who encountered that document had about the same attitude toward
towards interesting. It. That's interesting. So in the new age of Stuxnet, how important is the attribution problem, speaking of internet design? And should we change things around on the net to address that?
I don't think you can change things around to address the attribution problem, because so many of the problems are coming from compromised hosts. I mean, let's take a look at Stuxnet. It used stolen private keys mm-hmm. for trusted certificates. To this day, nobody knows how those keys were compromised, but the answer is somebody went around, either suborned an employee or hacked into the system of somebody who had a well-trusted key and just stole the key for their own purposes. Mm-hmm. The attribution technically, at the protocol level, points to J Micron in Taiwan. They had nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. Stepping stones have been an issue as far back as I've been in this business and before. The best kind of attribution, at least in published reports, seem to rely on a mix of technical clues and conventional intelligence, human, as they call it in the intelligence biz.
Yeah, I mean, so the Secretary of Defense, Panetta, I saw him speak last month, and he was talking as if they had made some progress on the attribution problem, and I was wondering what the heck they're talking about, but it must be the human front.
There have been published, I've seen the published reports making that claim. It does seem to be a lot of human. There have been, again, published reports saying that. When you look at some of the detailed analyses, it seems to be a lot of human effort. It's not the sort of thing that scales very well to automate. I don't think the fix is going to be in the protocols. In fact, it could just be a new way to throw up smoke screens.
Right.
Then there's the flip side. There is a lot of there's a lot of value to privacy and anonymity. And while it's easy to make a case that one should sacrifice anonymity for the sake of national security, it's a lot harder to make that case for the sake of giant marketers who are trying to gather information on everything I'm doing.
I'm in total agreement with you. And I think we have to be careful of our own freedoms as human beings, regardless of what country we live in.
Absolutely.
All right. So now I wanted to open a gigantic can of worms for the last question. So you have to promise not to talk forever on this one.
I'll do my best.
One of your interesting intellectual hobbies over the years involves public key crypto and nuclear weapons command and control systems, in particular permission action links called PALs and non-repudiation relative to National Security Memo 160. Tell us about that.
Well, it started at a conference. I'll skip the details. The retired chief cryptographer of NSA said that the basis for the NSA inventing public key crypto in the 60s was National Security Action Memorandum 160, which Kennedy had signed. Mm-hmm. And this was completely at variance with anything that's been published before or since. Mm-hmm. So Matt Blaze got the declassified version, got the Kennedy Library to sanitize, redact, and declassify the memo, and it said nothing particularly interesting, except maybe a hint at non-repudiation.
Right.
In the middle of a mostly blacked-out paragraph, there's one sentence left intact that could be interpreted as non-repudiation.
Right.
And, you know, if you think about that, if you ask the question the right way, it translates to digital signature.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's could have been what took NSA to do it. Look, we know that it took three civilian mathematicians 2 years to come up with digital signatures once the question was asked.
Right.
How long would it take NSA with its tens of millions of mathematicians to come up with it once somebody asked the question in the right way? So I find it plausible.
Right.
You know, the British invention of public key crypto, which has since been declassified, they invented public key encryption, not digital signatures.
Mm-hmm.
No one's ever made an earlier claim to digital signatures before Diffie and Hellman came up with the concept and Professor Shamir and Adelman made it practical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I did a lot of reading, a lot of research to try and figure out how these PALs worked to see if we shed more light on the subject. I've got a lot of interesting speculations and some declassified documents to say, but ultimately, it seems to be, you know, the best guess I have, if NSA invented it, it was digital signatures and inspired by reading this one sentence in the right way.
Right. Interesting. It's fun stuff. I enjoyed reading about that on the net.
Thanks.
And now, a very hard question, but very, very important. What is more fun, woodworking or trains?
Oh, that's a good question. I have to put it, woodworking at the moment, I haven't had a lot of time to play with my trains lately. So I haven't, not that I've had much time to woodworking lately either, but they're both, if you do it right, very creative activities. And the problem is I can only do one intensely creative thing at a time, whether it's working on a book and I'm working on a new one, or building some furniture, or building a model railroad layout.
Right.
And I can't use one to relax from the other because they all take too much mental energy.
I totally understand. Well, thank you, Steve. This has been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The November-December issue of IEEE S&P Magazine focuses on lost treasures from the ancient early days of computer security. See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigil.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.